Hamlet famously ponders, to be or not to be? That is the question. What he means is, should I keep living or should I kill myself? Although the English people will tell you that what's fascinating about Shakespeare's plays is he can, well before the time of the modern psychological novel, show such great psychological subconscious exploration in his characters. Because Hamlet never says, do I kill myself or not? It's almost as if he's pondering it as a philosophical question, but we know what he may not know, which is that he's pondering whether he should kill himself. Anyway, sidebar. To be or not to be, Hamlet ponders. That's the question. Is it nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune? Or, so as in to put up with the suffering of life, or to take arms against the sea of troubles by opposing, end them. To die, to sleep no more. And by sleep to say, we end the heartache of 1,000 natural shocks that flesh is heir to. Sounds good, he ponders. That's something to devoutly to be wished. To die, to sleep perchance to dream. But there's the rub. For in that sleep of death, what dreams may come. When we've shuffled off the mortal coil, it must give us pause. Why keep on living when things are just so hard? Why keep on living when the slings and arrows of fortune come your way? Why not end it all? But, whoa, hang on a second. Hey, well, if I end it all, what then? What dreams lie? What night terrors lie on the other side of the grave? You ever wrestle with that question, the question of death? Or recently I read a little novella, I suppose you could say, called Metroland by Julian Barnes. And in that he takes on the persona at first of a teenage high school boy in the 60s. And this boy says, there's very few things which I didn't confide in with my friend Tony. Very few things. Well, actually, there was only one thing I didn't talk to him about, and that was dying. We always laughed about it, except on the rare occasions when we knew the person involved. But I never really talked to my friend Tony about dying. I don't claim any originality for the time and location of my fear of the big D, dying. It tended to be in bed when I was unable to sleep. That's not that original. But I do claim one particularity. The fear of death would always arrive when I was lying on my right side, facing towards the window and the distant railway line. It would never come when I was on my left side, facing my bookshelves and the rest of my house. I don't know when you think about death, but there you have it. He goes on to say, once started, this fear could not be diminished by simply turning over. It had to be played out to the end. To this day, I have a preference for sleeping on my left side. What's the fear like? Can you relate to this? Can you remember these times? Do you still have these times? What's the fear of death like? Is it different for other people? I don't know. A sudden rising terror which takes you unawares. A surging need to scream, which house rules forbid. They always do. So that you lie there with your mouth open in a trembling panic, total wakefulness, which takes an hour to subside. And all this as a background to and a symptom of the central image, part visual, part intellectual, of non-existence. A picture of endlessly retreating stars. A sensation of total aloneness within your pyjamaed, shaking body. A realization of time, always capital T, going on without you forever and ever, and a persecuted sense of having been trapped in the present situation by a person or persons unknown. He says he doesn't really agree with people who say, oh, I don't really fear dying. I don't really worry about death. It's dying I can't stand. He says, no, that's not true. Nothing seems clearer in my nocturnal terrors than that death was no resemblance to sleep. I wouldn't mind dying at all, I thought, as long as I didn't end up dead at the end of it. Death, a heavy subject. A taboo subject, I think far more of a taboo subject than sex. Death, we are all going to die. How do you make sense of that? How do you deal with that fact? All of us are gonna die. Do you ignore it, escapism? Do you intellectualize it, kind of depersonalize it and philosophize about it? Do you romanticize it and somehow like, yeah, I'm thinking about death. I've written a song about it actually, babe. Do you sentimentalize it as Forrest Gump, death is just a part of life, Jimmy? Or are you overwhelmed by it? Is it something that frightens you, worries you, that burdens you? Is it something you're actually sadly dealing with right now? Someone close to you passing away. Ecclesiastes, as we've gone through it, has contemplated many unwelcome things, unpopular things, grim things. It says, you need to face the brutal facts. And looks you in the face and says, you've got to hear this. It says in chapter 7 that it's far better to be at a funeral than to be at a party. There is more wisdom at a funeral than a party because we're going to die. So there's no denial here in this book, Ecclesiastes. There's no escapism here, no cliches and sentimentalism or art posering. This is real life. This is for real. It prepares you for life, not just a motivational pump-up. It equips you to be resilient, not naive or escapist, to be prepared. In the Bible, death is not a natural thing. It's not just a part of life, a cycle that we all go through. But human death, in particular, is seen of as an enemy, the last great enemy, a dehumanizing thing. That humans were made to know God, to be in relationship with Him, to live forever is the Bible's description of God's purposes for humans. And that death was the result of us turning from God. And so the Bible laments the fact that humans will just become like the animals, will just die like the rabbits and the bilbies and the bugs. That there's something lost in human glory, in human death. It's a judgment of God. It's being cut loose from the source of life. And as it unfolds in the Bible, there's particularly three aspects to it. There's the physical, there's the spiritual death first. A sense that really, once you turn away from God, in a sense, you're the walking dead. You're the dead man walking. You've turned away from the one where life really comes from, where meaning really comes from. And so, in a sense, you're dead already when you let go of your Maker. The spiritual death. But God's response to spiritual death is physical death. That human death is a judgment from God. God said to Adam back in the Genesis story, you've turned away from me, you've rejected me, and so you will toil all your life and then you will return to the dust. From dust you were made and to dust you'll return. Physical death. But then beyond that physical death, the Bible speaks, as the final verses of Ephesians chapter 12 speak, here, of a judgment to come, of a final time when God will hold us to account, a final assessment of who we are, and then an eternal death for those who have said no to God. We're here at this close to the book, a book that began with a poem about the circularity and futility of the natural world. And now here we are at the end of the book as we contemplate human mortality, and a poem about human mortality. We have a final call to joy in verses 7 to 10. You see that their light is sweet, 11 verse 7. It pleases the eye. However years a man may live, let him enjoy them all. Call to joy. That's a familiar theme in the book. And then we get this poem about mortality. 12 verse 1, remember the Creator in the days of your youth before the trouble comes. 12 verse 6, remember Him before the silver cord is severed or the golden bowl is broken and the pitcher is shattered at the well and the wheel broken at the well. Remember God in your youth. As the book began talking about the wind going around and around and the sun rising and setting and so now it's the breath of the human dropping away and it's the sun growing dim. Remember. And then in verses 9 to 12, the teacher who wrote this whole book is commended to us. And then finally we have the end of the matter. And so that we're going to follow along those lines. Remember, rejoice in your youth. Remember old age. And then we have here the commendation of the teacher and the end of the matter. I have a catchy title for that third one that Facebook helped me with, but now I've forgotten off the top of my head, so you'll get to see that when we get to that point anyway. So, remember old age. I'll find it now. Here we go. Just put you on hold. The beginning of wisdom and the end of the matter. There you go. That's kind of nice. Cute. Lovely. All right, so let's start anyway. Rejoice in your youth. That's a thread the whole book has had woven through it. Remember God in your youth. Oh, sorry, rejoice rather, in your youth. Rejoice. As often as the book says, meaningless, meaningless, utterly meaningless, as much as there's that refrain, there's also this refrain of rejoice. Enjoy life. Celebrate. Enjoy food. Enjoy wine. Enjoy sex. Enjoy marriage. Enjoy work. Enjoy achievements. Enjoy your youth. An exhortation to rejoice. God says it. You're being sinful if you don't learn to enjoy life. If you think that somehow misery and drudgery, that's not God's call. God says, no, to obey me is to receive my gifts with joy. It's a weird thought, isn't it? It's like this secondary answer in the book. The big answer is in the end of chapter 12, to know God and obey him. But as you live in life, in this life with its shades of grey and with the pending mortality, with the struggles and the difficulties, learning to find joy is important. Enjoy light and the sun, verse 7. Light is sweet and it pleases the eyes to see the sun. Simple pleasure, isn't it? Gosh, it's a nice pleasure as the days get shorter and the weather colder, isn't it? I almost, in our HQ where the staff work out of, I almost squash the real estate lady who works downstairs. She goes into the courtyard to have ciggies more often than she sells houses. But she was in the only area where there was sun, was behind where the door opens. And so I charged through and opened the door and... she was fine, actually. Don't worry. No real estate agents were harmed in the making of this sermon. But she was enjoying the sun. The warmth on your skin. It's lovely, isn't it? Get your vitamin D. The relaxation it brings. The health and life it brings. Light dancing on the water. Shining through the autumn leaves. Bending around the planet as the sun rises. It's gorgeous, isn't it? Simple pleasure. A good pleasure and a reminder of the generous mercy of God. Jesus says God is loving. He shines the sun on his enemies and his friends, gives rain to his enemies and his friends. It's a gorgeous symbol of youth and of life. And so we then get in verse 10, enjoy this whole spread of your life. However many years a man may live, let him enjoy them all. Enjoy the whole spread of your life from 0 to 100 or whatever it is. Enjoy life. You know, we live in a society that can, to some extent, worship youth. Is that a fair comment? That often, at least there's certain trends to always say, no, youth is where it's at. That's where life's all about. And so you've got to kind of pile on more anti-aging creams to try and stay young. And there's this tragic series of won't they ever end sequels of gradually aging baby boomer action heroes trying to prove that they can still blow up helicopters with motorbikes if they want to. And it's all about, you know, no, we could just prolong life a little bit more. You and I, we're going to be forever young. I want to be forever young. And that's what we can be somehow. Don't buy into that worship of youth. You've got a whole life ahead of you. Don't build your values now so you're spending the rest of your life wishing you could be what you were at some other time in your life. Plan to live your whole life, won't you? However many years a man may live, let him enjoy them all. Be an old dog who learns new tricks, won't you? Age gracefully, won't you, rather than resentfully or resignedly? Yes, there are perks of youth. We'll get that into the next little verse. But there are certainly perks of youth, but there are different privileges and pleasures at different stages of life. Having hopefully become a bit wise, learnt from your mistakes, built in some discipline, seeing the fruits of your hard work playing out in your life, in your relationships, perhaps even in your bank account. Feeling a bit more comfortable in your old skin and enjoying being a bit more of an old dog who could just say what you think because you don't really care anymore. There are certain perks to different stages of life. Be that kind of person. Don't just be a person who's all that forever young. And just always just kind of trying to live just for you. But be someone who is happy to give to those who come after you. Invest in the next generation. And when you move on from leading the youth group, you invest in the next lot of youth group leaders. And when you grow up and get into your career, you're someone who's mentoring those others in the organization without having to be asked or paid or ramroded into it or be noticed for it. Be someone who invests in others. One of my mentors, preacher David Jones, as a young man, was a man who took risks. What a handsome young Welsh man who bravely left a denomination that had given up on the gospel, and at great financial cost and risk, had to start a church with very little support, and his family had to live in some sort of Welsh house that was half burnt down. You know, it was a pretty kind of rock and roll thing to do, rock and roll Welsh punk preacher. And that's as a young man. But then as a middle-aged man of First Presbyterian Church in Hobart, stepped out in the year 2000 and planted a church with a bunch of newly converted uni students, of which I was one, and started a new church. He could have stayed put. He was respected. He was successful. But he threw it all away and was again willing to be an old dog learning new tricks. And then having done that, about a year later, started yet another church called Cornerstone, and a few years later started yet another church called Mount Stuart Presbyterian Church. I hate to think what he's going to do in retirement. But there's something inspirational about that. He and his wife are people who have youth in their eyes. They haven't retired on life. I can't wait to see The Great Gatsby. I don't know about you, but I reckon Baz is all right. We'll pretend Australia never happened. Let's not talk about that. But Romeo and Juliet, I thought, was a winner. And Strictly Ballroom, if you haven't seen that, was also good fun. So I'm a bit of a Baz fan, not ashamed to say it. And things just got better for Leo after Titanic. So, you know, I've got plenty of time for him as well. But that theme song that's been on the radio, it's quite spine-tingling, isn't it? Have you heard that one? Will You Still Love Me When I'm No Longer Young and Beautiful? I've seen the world, she recalls youth, and lit up the stage now, channeling angels in the new age now. It's all summer days and rock and roll and the way you'd play for me at your show and all the ways I got to know your pretty face and your electric soul, but will you still love me when I'm no longer young and beautiful? Will you still love me when I got nothing but my aching soul? It's quite a chilling song. And a scary question. Will you be someone who loves others as they are no longer old and beautiful? Will you be someone who is in loving relationships as you age or become more and more alone and isolated? Burn the bridges of your life. Life is not over as you age. Life is not over when you're slow and sick and aging and aching in pain. And we as Christians who value people for who they are, not merely for what they do, should be the first to care and give dignity to those as they age. Well, care for the aged is a legal issue, of course. There's all questions about exactly when it is right and compassionate to end life and all that kind of stuff. It's a legal issue to wrestle with. But beyond the legal issue, which we ought to care about, is the compassion issue, the value issue. In our country, we're getting old. In our state, we're getting old quicker. And so genuinely sincere and holistic palliative care and aged care and respect for the old people in our lives is a fundamental problem. We'll be spending most of our lives propping up this massive generation of old people. Will we do it with respect and love and honour? Or disdain and resentment and dismissiveness? Then he goes on to say, as you enjoy the spread of your life, especially be happy while you're young. Look at verse 9. Be happy, young man, while you are young. And let your heart give you joy in the days of your youth. Follow the ways of your heart, and whatever your eyes see, enjoy your youth. Yes, there's something great about youth. The light is sweet. You're young, you're strong, you're beautiful. The rock and roll shows, it's all fun. And yay, you're young. You're not, yes, chapter 12. Sun and moon growing dark, clouds returning after the rain, keepers of the house trembling, and the strong men stooping, and the grinders eating. You're not there yet. Lucky you. So enjoy it, won't you? Because you're going to get there very quickly. Enjoy your youth. There's great blessings of youth that are gifts from God to enjoy. Strength, opportunity, novelty, You haven't heard it before. You don't know who they're ripping off. And so it sounds fresh and new to you. Yay. And you haven't been there yet. And now you're there. Take a photo of yourself there and share it on Facebook. No one cares. You're beautiful, some of you. You're strong. You're energetic. You can have fun. There is hope. Youth is about, there's a future ahead of you. It's great. Enjoy it. The Bible says. God says it. I believe it. That's Dad. The Bible says enjoy your life. Say grace. You don't just have to do it for dinner. Say thanks for all God's good gifts. It's good and right to enjoy your life. And this time of life you're in now, those young men and women, it's a time of great freedom. You're not a kid anymore. And relatively limited responsibility. You're not in charge of anything yet, except maybe locking up the pizza shop at the end of the night for an extra 50 cents an hour. Relatively speaking, great freedom, low responsibility, relatively speaking. That's a great perk. Yes, you feel the burden of your study, I get that. But life is going to get worse from here. There'll be work and there'll be kids, there'll be debt, there'll be life, there'll be health issues. It just keeps on coming. So while you have your youth, make sure you enjoy, keep yourself fit and enjoy your physical health. As you're able, enjoy friends and making friends. That's great hearing. That's one of the great parts of mid-year conference, as Simon was saying, to meet new people, as Lauren was saying, to meet new people. Enjoy that perk. Step out and say hi to someone new. It's kind of scary, but you might make it a stranger's just a friend you've never met. Enjoy the social dimension of life. Enjoy sport. Enjoy travel to see the world. All these things, art, education, music, enjoy life. Don't waste your youth growing up too quickly. Being too much of a hurry to, you know, get your first house, first business, first everything. But don't waste your life either, your youth either, on mere trivia, on mere The Voice, computer games, routine. Chapter 11, verses 1 to 6 urge us to be willing to risk. Try new things, to step outside our comfort zone. Don't waste your youth by growing up too quickly. Don't waste your youth on trivia. Don't waste your youth on merely temporary things. Look at verse 9 again. Enjoy your youth while you're young. Let your heart give you joy in the days of your youth. Follow the ways of your heart, whatever your eyes see. But know that all these things God will bring you to judgment. Live your youth in the light of the future. Live your youth in the light of eternal things. Enjoy your youth living for eternal things, not merely for a degree that'll be here today and tomorrow thrown into the fire. Not merely for travel and experience and that will be forgotten. Life is more than degrees. Life is more than property. Life is more than shoes. Life is more than Kentucky tours. Life is more. And amongst other things, you're going to have to give an account on the final day before God of how you spent your 20s. Come across to Matthew chapter 6 as Jesus speaks on this matter very bluntly in a way that Jesus is unforgiving, isn't he, sometimes in his preaching? Really is, can be ferocious at getting at our heart and our priorities. It's kind of crisis preaching that he gives us, isn't it? He really gets under the skin to say, what are you really thinking about? What are you really living for? Matthew chapter 6, verse 19, he says, don't store up for yourself treasures on earth where moth and rust destroy, where thieves break in and steal. But store up for yourself treasures in heaven, where moth and rust do not destroy, and where thieves do not break in and steal. And here's the KO. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be. Where is your treasure? What is your precious? What do you strive for? What do you take pride in? What makes you swell? What makes you delight? What are you really keen for? Is it the things of God, the things of eternity? Or is it a straight A, HD, your team getting into the finals? Remember your Creator in the days of your youth before the days of trouble come and the years approach when you say, I find no pleasure in them. Ecclesiastes 12, verse 1. Use your youth, use your strength, use your freedom, use your energy for things that really matter. And then verse 10, it's 11 verse 10 of Ecclesiastes, the teacher says, banish anxiety. Ecclesiastes 11 verse 10. So then, banish anxiety from your heart and cast off the troubles of your body, for youth and vigor are meaningless. Cheerful. Anxiety, doesn't it? It shrinks life. Doesn't it suffocate us in into smaller and smaller worries? It doesn't change anything. Jesus is good at that, isn't he? As in the same passage we just read, he goes on to say, don't worry about food and clothes and these things. Pagans worry about those things. Come on. God looks after you. You can't add an hour to your life by worrying. Just add another miserable hour to your life. There's enough worry in your life already. If you're going to worry, just put a timer on it. Get an app. Worry about today. There'll be plenty to worry about there. Don't worry about tomorrow. Let tomorrow worry about itself. Today has enough worries of its own, Jesus says. Don't worry. Worry, you see. Anxiety, you see. I know for some of us it's a habit. It's an illness to some extent. And sure, you know, I don't want to go on a guilt trip, but worry is accidental idolatry sometimes, isn't it? It's accidentally not realizing God's the one in charge, not you. It's accidentally thinking that by me knowing, me controlling, me worrying, me going over and over and over in my head, somehow I'll fix it. Well, you can't. You're not God. Worrying is an accidental idolatry, accidentally making ourselves God. And to learn our place in the world, as Ecclesiastes has been taking this hard, stern road to remind us of our place in the world, that we're creations, creatures, not creators and gods. We're human beings, mere mortals, not gods. As the counselors say, get your worries and put them on a leaf and let them float down the river. Put them in your journal and get them out of your head. As the Bible says, cast your anxieties on Him, on God, for He cares for you. He cares for you. He listens. Or as the examples of the Psalms, it's a great psalm, isn't it? Why are you downcast, O my soul? What's he doing? He's kind of preaching to himself, isn't he? Preach to yourself. Come on, my soul, put your faith in God. Trust in Him. He's faithful. He's good. Preach to yourself. It's a little bit weird if you're in a residential college and people can hear through the walls, but heck, they vomited and you could hear them, so it's only fair, you know, they get a sermon back as revenge, you know. And you can call up the residential assistant and preach at them too, you know, so there you go. But notice there in verse 10, it picks up the fact that worry also gets into your bones. Banish anxiety from your heart and the troubles from your body. Often anxiety knots up your stomach. Tightens your shoulders, locks your jaws. And then when someone points it out and you actually relax, you go, whoa, my, how many days have I been like some kind of orc? How long has that been going on for? So as we're looking at this passage in the lunchtime meeting, we kind of decided that, well, God says go and get a massage. There you go, right there. Go and get some exercise. Eat well. Remember to breathe. Banish anxiety from your heart. You're not God. Life, in a sense, your whole life, in a sense, is transient. It's meaningless. It goes so quickly. So don't learn, in a sense, you could say, to take God very seriously and yourself less seriously. It's quite a helpful way of thinking, isn't it? Let God become bigger and your worries become smaller. Banish anxiety from your heart. Don't live your life in a stress ball knot. Banish anxiety from your body. Take care of your body in your youth. Manage your body well. There's a very famous preacher from Scotland, Murray McShane, Robert Murray McShane, 19th century preacher. He graduated from Edinburgh University when he was 14 and then went on in 23 to pastor a church of over 1,000 people. Very famous for his Bible reading program. But he died at 29 because he just flogged himself so hard in his ministry, his life. But just before he died, here's what he said. Very sadly, really, as he reflected on that, on how hard he worked himself and how quickly he ruined himself. God gave me a message to deliver, and God gave me a horse to ride, by which he means this physical body. God gave me a message to deliver, and God gave me a horse to ride. I've killed the horse, and now I can't deliver the message. So learn to rejoice in your youth as part of your worship of God, the Bible is saying. And perhaps you'll be able to ride that horse a little longer for the glory of God and for the love of other people. Some of you are too good at saying no, aren't you? You really should take on a bit more for the gospel. Some of you are lousy at saying no. And you're going to kill that horse. So for the sake of making a long-term impact for the good of others around you, learn to say no, won't you? It's wise to rejoice. It's wise to take pleasure in life. It honours God to receive his good gifts. And how much greater to rejoice when we're at peace with him and we know what's in store when Jesus comes back. Let's move on to the second point. Remember old age. 11 verse 7 to 10 begins this. It says, enjoy life, but remember the days of darkness, for there'll be many. Everything to come is meaningless. Be happy while you're young, but remember God will bring you into judgment. And then chapter 12 picks up this theme at length. Get ready for death. Get ready. You will die. You are mortal. Be ready for death. Jean-Paul Sartre, in his short story, The Wall, reflects on how it would be to be condemned to death. And he takes on this character of someone condemned to death. And this person says, in the state I was in, if someone had told me I could go home quietly and that I would leave my life whole, you're pardoned. That would have left me cold. Several hours or several years of waiting to die is all the same when you have lost the illusion of being eternal. Have you lost the illusion of being immortal? The way you live your life should be preparing for the one certain thing ahead of you, your death. Are you living and planning your life and basing your happiness all on the assumption that you will be young and beautiful and capable and successful? Is there anything in the way you are living and planning and thinking about your life that will be able to cope with serious chronic injury, sickness, or hardship? Or that just shipwreck your life? Is there anything in the way you're living and thinking and building your life that will prepare you for old age and retirement? Is there anything in the way you're living and thinking and building your life that will prepare you for when you die? 12 verse 1, remember your Creator in the days of your youth, before the days of trouble come and the years approach when you will say, I find no pleasure in them. And he gives this poem, this description of aging, doesn't he? In verse 2, before the sun and the light and the moon and the stars grow dark, I'm going blind. And the clouds return after rain. Sickness just seems to be the norm rather than the exception. I get very good friends with my doctor because I seem to always be there, and I have more pills than food nowadays. And a fall can mean a hospital visit. And funerals are more common than parties. The winter of life. Verse 3, this crumbling mansion of your body when the keepers of the house tremble and the strong men stoop and the grinders cease because they are few and those looking through the windows grow dim and when the doors of the street are closed and the sound of grinding fades. Your strong body, your powerful body, your young body, your beautiful body will crack and will lean and will rot and will ruin and the teeth will go and the hair will thin and the back will arch and the skin will get all rubbery and smell old and your humour will just be, you know, daggy if not dirty, and your hospitality will go from this great delight to kind of cold tea and microwave pies and soft biscuits and you worry. Look at verse 4 and 5. Men rise at the sound of the birds, but the song grows faint. And men are afraid of heights and the dangers in the streets these days. The almond leaves there is the white hair sprouting. and we're lame like a grasshopper dragging ourselves along, and the desire is no longer stirred as sexual vigor drains away, and then death. Verse 6, remember him before the silver cord is severed, before the golden bowl is broken, before the pitcher is shattered at the well, or the wheel, at the spring, or the wheel broken at the well. And the dust returns to the ground it came from, and the spirit returns to God who gave it. Meaningless, meaningless, says the teacher. Everything is meaningless. You are going to die. You are mortal. Deal with it. Tom Waits sings, "What does it matter, a dream of love or a dream of lies? We're all going to be in the same place when we die. Your spirit don't leave knowing your face or your name, and the wind through your bones is all that remains, and we're all going to be just dirt in the ground. Ask a king or a beggar, and the answer they'll give, we're all going to be just dirt in the ground." It's a story of a king who went in search of to find the greatest fool in his kingdom, and he sent his men out to the four corners, and eventually they found someone. Sorry, it's you, James, I'm afraid. James Spirit Keys Weller, greatest fool in the world. And he's brought to the king, and he's given his fool scepter and his fool jester hat, and here he is, the greatest fool in the kingdom. Many years later, the king grew sick and began to die. And he called the fool in to amuse him and said, "James, I'm about to go on a great journey." And the fool responds, "Oh, goodness, what preparations have you made?" "Why, none." And so the fool takes off his jester's hat and his fool's rod and hands it to the king. "Well, you can have these then, because you're a greater fool than I am. There's one thing that's certain for you, and then you're going to die. Or the Lord Jesus returns. What preparations are you making for that? Are you ready for your death? Are you at peace with your Maker? Remember your Creator in the days of your youth, before the days of trouble come and the year approach when you will say, 'I find no pleasure in it.'" Verse 6, remember him before the silver cord is severed. Remember, now is the time. "Oh, after uni, then I'll really get serious about God. Oh, there's a lot going on with getting married, or there's this project that I'm working on. I'll sort things out with God later. I'm having some fun now, and kind of secretly, I reckon a few years later, I'll quit smoking and sort things out with God and all those sorts of things. I'll deal with them later, get a gym membership." That is playing a risky business. I know some of you are thinking that. Some of you have friends talk that way. You say, "Have you ever thought about God? Have you ever thought?" "No, I haven't really thought about it." Risky business. It's assuming you're going to want to later. Assuming you'll be able to later. Life could just go. And that's the chance gone. And open-minded as you are now, you'll be surprised how hardened up you get, how flippant you can get. You're now in a position to consider the things of eternal significance. You're here thinking about it. Do business with the things that matter most and work out from there. It's the most urgent matters. It doesn't get easier later. You talk to a chaplain in an old person's home. It's not like everyone there is going. Everyone there still thinks they're kind of going to live forever. They're still putting it off. And they'd rather talk about Wheel of Fortune or whatever it's called nowadays. They're still putting it off and just wanting to complain about the soft peas and how they're no good. Or there's not some later date where you become earnest about these things. There's always something to put it off. Do business with the things that matter most, won't you? And live your life in the light of things that matter, won't you? This may be your chance. Here, now, you may drift later. You may lose sight of the shore like someone caught in a rip, just pulled away. This one's for the share house people out there. What's the deal with the empty, I mean, it's a bit crass of an illustration, to forgive me for that. What's the deal with the empty toilet roll in the toilet? Is there ever going to be a more convenient time to change the toilet roll than when you are actually on level with the toilet roll? For fair enough reasons. Is there going to be some other time when you're going to be in quite such a convenient place to reach over, get a new roll, and replace the toilet roll? And then you can build a little share house pyramid of empty toilet rolls as well, for lols. That's the time, surely, to do it, right? Here you are. The analogy kind of gets a little bit crass as we try and map it across. But here you are. What better time to really think about these things, to really pray to God and say, God, if you're there, help me figure this out. Or if you know, you're just, it's kind of all deferring a bit, and you're kind of not really taking God seriously. It's just kind of partly just you kind of grew up with it. And what better time to really say, God, what do you want with my life? What's your plan for my life? What better time is there going to be? And it can be a killer, I know. The studies are demanding, and sometimes even Christian parents don't help. Focus on your studies, because as Jesus says, the most important thing in life is getting a good degree, as it says in the Bible on 3 Opinions, chapter 10. I know that can be hard. It's of relative insignificance. Far more important is being right with God, living for Him. Give generously now as you're able. Pray diligently now as you're able. Grow in faith and knowledge and godliness now. Set the trajectory of your life. Prayer and books and conferences. There'll be seasons in your life when it will be hard to find much time to think, study, learn, grow. And you will actually be running off what's in the tank from these years of your life. What are you putting in there? How much really are you running off? A couple of memory verses from youth group? And two or three little sort of popular level books you got from Kurong, half read? Or are you deepening in your faith, enriching your foundation in God? Grow in wisdom. And that brings us to point three, the beginning of wisdom. Look at verse 9 there. Verse 9. Not only was the teacher wise, but he also imparted knowledge to the people. He pondered and searched out and set in order many proverbs. The teacher searched to find just the right words, and what he wrote was upright and true. The words of the wise are like goads. They're collected sayings like firmly embedded nails given by one shepherd. Be warned, my son, of making anything in addition to them. Of many books there is no end, and much study wearies the body. It's this summary commendation of the author of this whole book. You know, like you get a DVD from the shop and maybe a friend's gone to get it and they come home and they go, it said on the cover, if you liked X, awesome film, then you'll like Y, the film your mate's got. Now, that's a dead giveaway that this film's going to suck, right? You know, if you liked awesome film, then the guys who made this were trying to copy it. Or when you get like the movie is Disney film 2, generally like warning, get out while you still can. You know, Lion King 2, Simba's Misery. You know, when something is 5 stars, Alabama Messenger, or MoofyFun.com. You know, maybe not so much. By the best boy and key grip of Iron Man 2. Yeah. But if Margaret and David like it, particularly David, you're onto a good thing. Here we have this book commended to us by God. He's saying, listen to this teacher. And listen to this teacher because listen to him. He is wise, he is thoughtful, he has worked hard, he's searched out. What he says is right and true. Listen to this stuff. Pay attention to this stuff. And then he rattles off a whole bunch of stuff about wisdom. And I know things are getting on, so I'll just number these off and we'll preach that sermon another day. Wisdom is to be taught, verse 9. 5 things about wisdom. Wisdom is to be taught. You're not wise if it's just you just a know-it-all. Wisdom is to benefit others. Wisdom is to be taught. Secondly, wisdom is hard work. See that in verse 9 and 10? He pondered and searched and set in order and searched and struggled. Wisdom is not easy. love TED Talks. They make us feel smart, but teach us hardly anything. Real learning is hard work. Come to mid-year conference. Third, wisdom is both pleasant but painful. Verse 10, the teacher searched out to find just the right words. Many of the translations opt for pleasing words. It's that sense of just right, fitting. Just so, the beauty of truth. Wisdom, when you see it, when you understand the gospel, it's beautiful, isn't it? Wisdom is beautiful, but it's also painful. See that in verse 11? The words of the wise are like goads. They're collected sayings like firmly embedded nails. That's uncomfortable too. You know a bad preacher if they always just make you want to do the pew move. You know a bad preacher if you always go going, oh, that was lovely, wasn't it? Oh, it was just so inspiring. You know a good preacher if you, on a regular basis, feel kind of irritated with them, a bit annoyed, they've gotten under your skin a little bit. And then we say, oh yeah, they may not be a good preacher, but they're a lovely pastor. Rubbish. A good pastor also will get under your skin and say things you don't want to hear. Rub you the wrong way. Not scratch you where you're itchy. Scratch you where you're not itchy, so as to start making you itchy there. Not answering your questions for God, but letting God ask you the questions he wants to ask you. And a good friend is someone who says the things you don't want to hear, isn't it? Get around your friends, say the things you don't want to hear. They are friends to keep. They're keepers, they are. And even if at first you get a bit irritated at them and defensive, go back and say sorry and say thank you. I need people like you in my life. True wisdom is from God is the fourth thing it says about wisdom. From one shepherd, verse 11. So be careful about adding to wisdom. There is such thing as truth. All truth is God's truth. Science, morality, skill, all in the end is part of God's great world that he made. So don't mess around with wisdom. Truth is truth. And the fifth thing there is, wisdom is however limited. Verse 12, right at the end there, it's a great one for you, a gift for you for swap back. Of many books there is no end, and much study where is the body. Bam, there you go. So you can learn forever, raise questions forever, integrate all the world's religions again and again and again forever. Much study wearies the body. Study with no goal. Study with no end. Study not with love. Study just with more study. It's a futile business. But let's move on to the final point, the end of the matter. Verse 13. Now all has been heard, and here is the conclusion of the matter. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. For God will bring every deed into judgment, including every hidden thing, whether good or evil. That's the ultimate answer of the book. We saw it in chapter 5. Go near to the house of God to listen rather than speak. Fear God. And now here it is. Remember your Creator in the days of your youth. Remember him before the silver cord is severed. Fear God and keep his commandments. Know him. Fear is just describing the correct relationship to the God. You know, just kind of follow him, like him. You fear him, admire him, honor him. Fear God and obey him. That's the whole duty of man. Although if you can see there, look at duty. It's got little square things sitting down the bottom there. Like it's kind of, I don't know, to be perforated, cut out and something. That's because that word isn't there in the Hebrew text. It's kind of a paraphrastic attempt to capture the thought. The original text just simply said, this is the whole of man. This is you. This is what you are. This is what it means to be human. It's to know God and to obey him. That's what life's about. To be truly human is to know God and obey him. Everything comes from there. That's what life is for. That's what you're for. What's it do? It looks good, but what's it do? Well, it knows God and obeys his commands. All of your life, your art, your work, your study, your pleasure is from him and is lived through him and for him. He's the center around which everything else orbits and gets its significance. Now, I worry that you might think I spent more time this week thinking about watching The Great Gatsby than I did preparing the sermon, because I have another little reference to the film. This came from a Triple J the other morning. Baz Luhrmann, the director, was being interviewed. And most of the interview was dumb, but right at the very end he said this, and I thought this was great. This film speaks about who we are. Look, is there a lot of razzle-dazzle that people go on about? Yes. Are there parties? Fantastic. Can you dress up? Go for it. But at the end, there's a contemplation. There are basically four or five characters in a room saying, but you love him. And it ends with a devastated young man going, materialism cannot be the focus of your life. It might be nice to have a good suit, now go to a great party and drink a few cocktails. But you've got to have a purpose, and you've got to have a cause. And that's what he learns from Jay Gatsby. You have to have a point to your life. Razzle-dazzle. Yeah, you can have razzle-dazzle, nice suit, good cocktails, lots of fun, go for it. What's the point of your life? God gives meaning. He will bring every deed into judgment, verse 14 says. He is the one who shapes, defines, interprets our life. It's good news that above the sun, beyond the grave, there's a meaning to everything. It all goes somewhere. It's not just dust and ashes. It all goes somewhere. It's not just a dream or a nightmare. Who knows what? God will evaluate all, will define all, will bring everything to a climax. He will straighten out what's crooked, make up what is lacking, give lasting gain, give answers to the riddles. But it is bad news for you and I, because we don't fear God and keep his commands. We don't, you and I, we don't, I don't. And when we will all stand before the judgment seat of Jesus Christ, and he will bring every deed into judgment, whether good or bad, we are exposed. We're undone. You and I, all of us. Because we say no to God, we've all done it, I've done it, we live without him, we live against him, or we live ignoring him. It just could be just as bad. Half-hearted creatures in our service of the one who made us, thankless. And our regrets, our mistakes, the guilt in the pit of our stomachs, in the back of our heads, the things we're ashamed of if another would find out about, the secrets, the embarrassments, the lies. And they just add up as life goes on, and we can't go back and change them, we can't fix them all up, we can't make them go away, we can't make it right. Things are wrong with us. With us and God, with us and each other, with us and ourselves. And the wise one sees that we are wrong with God and that God is in the right. The wise one sees that there is death and then there is judgment, and then who can stand? Who can stand? The wise one says there is death, and then we all have to give an account to God, and then there is outer darkness. For those who've turned from God, who have no pardon, there's nothing but what Jesus called the weeping and the gnashing of teeth. He never felt such aloneness before. Where's my wife? He choked. Only that awful echo. Not here. Your wife is not here. He tried to piece it all together, but the darkness was too thick. Once in a while, he thought he could see a blurred figure or hear an anguished moan. He remembered the pain. He remembered those last moments of terror. But it was nothing compared to the feeling that was creeping into his awareness now. Again, he cried, "Where's my wife?" "Your wife is not here." "Where are my children?" "Your children are not here." He started to grope about in the darkness, but all was blindness. "My God," he hailed, "let me feel the presence of one single human being." "My God." He hadn't said those words in such a long time. "My God." And now they seemed so hollow. Terror was welling up in him. He felt like a small child being threatened by deep darkness. No candles anywhere. No love anywhere, no voice anywhere. "Where's my wife?" he screamed. "Your wife is not here." "Where are my children?" he called. "Your children are not here." And then the greatest fear of all came to his mind. He was terrified to ask, but he knew he would have to. And his whole body trembled as he pursed his lips and he wailed into the nebulous night, "Where, oh where is God?" As the deepest of all darkness closed in on his soul for all eternity, he heard that hideous echo whispering that most horrifying of all judgments, "God is not here." There is only one place, there is only one way, there is only one hope for the human race. And it's the sure hope of the death of Jesus Christ, God, in our place. All the guilt, the mistakes, the shame, the death, the darkness, on him instead of us. And for any who receive him, for any who turn to Jesus and say, "I'm not right with God, I'm in trouble," he makes us right with him and sure that after death there's no fear, there's no wrath. So in the end, this is the whole of man. Jesus on the cross. This is the whole of man. The empty tomb, because he's risen again. Remember that while you're young. Invite the band up and let's pray. Our loving Father, please give us the wisdom, time, and the humility to learn about what you have to say to us, to prepare for what's ahead of us, to make peace with you through the blood of your Son, Jesus Christ, who forgives us our sins and gives us the sure hope of life forever. We praise you and thank you so much for your mercy. In his name we pray. Amen.